This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Welcome, history lovers, to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul. This is your HedgeGhoul master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. And in today's podcast, we'll be discussing the Government of Ireland Act 1920, 100 years of partition. Originally conceived as a temporary amendment to the Third Home Rule Act on the statute book since 1914, the 1920 Government of Ireland Act was presciently derided by the Freeman's Journal as the Dismemberment of Ireland Bill. Partition was the only element of it to have endured. How did it come about? What were its effects over the following century? And on the panel today, we have Martin Manser, a former special advisor to the Irish government on Northern Ireland. Cormac Moore, author of Birth of the Border, The Impact of Partition in Ireland. And Margaret O'Callaghan and Brian Walker, both of Queen's University, Belfast. This HedgeGhoul is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries initiative. Now, just to get started, let's sketch the situation, say, in the second half of the 19th century. Already differences were emerging between the North, or more precisely the Northeast, which was predominantly Protestant, industrialized, politically pro-British, and which was experiencing demographic expansion. The South, on the other hand, was predominantly Catholic, agricultural, anti-British politically, and was experiencing demographic decline. So, Cormac Moore, if I go to you first, you know, are we talking here about one nation or two nations? I mean, how does this fit into 19th century essentialist, if you like, notions of nationality and identity?
Thanks, Tommy. The whole concept of two nations or one nation can be quite problematic, because it kind of just fits into the binary opposition of nationalists versus unionists, where there were a lot of complexities and ambiguities within nationalism, within unionism, and geographically as well. And clearly there were differences between the Northeast and the rest of Ireland. You look at, obviously, with religion or with economy, there's marked differences there. But then if you look at even at the Northeast, there's marked differences between Belfast and rural Ulster. Rural Ulster had more in common with other rural parts of Ireland. If you were to say that there was two nations, you could just as easily be talking about the East versus the West of Ireland, rather than North versus the South. And this whole idea of two nations really became kind of a concept within Ulster Unionism from the late 19th century, and drove on really, particularly during the Third Home Rule Crisis. In fact, most of the writing celebrating that the story of the Ulster Man, it was mainly written from 1913 to 1923, and during the height of the Home Rule Crisis and when partition was being actively negotiated. So it was more for political purposes than anything really that it became such an idea. Like if you look at the late 19th century, as there was a groundswell of opposition to Home Rule from Ulster. Most Ulster Unionists would still have considered themselves Irish people. In fact, at the Ulster Unionist Convention of 1892, there was a big banner outside the conference hall, Éireann go bra, which means Ireland forever. But by 1912, the use of the word Irish had become a term of abuse, and Ulster Unionism were vehemently opposed to the Gaelic revival movement and the Irish language.
So maybe if I could bring in Brian Walker on this, Brian, because is there a sense that the electoral system, the first past the post electoral system, is what has led to this simplistic notion, this binary, idea of two camps? Just talk to us a little bit about that. What was the electoral landscape of the country, say, from the 1880s onwards?
Well, may I first respond on this question of two nations? I have to say, I find very little evidence of ideas of two nations in the late 19th century, or indeed the early 20th century. Most of these unionists, North and South, saw themselves as Irish. Now, they were also British subjects and British citizens, and they were very keen on that. But they still saw themselves as Irish, part of Ireland. Now, in 1912, you do get a move towards a more Ulster identity, but that doesn't remove the Irish concept. But these are Irish unionists. It's quite interesting, in Parliament, T.P. O'Connor challenges Ronald McNeill, who is an Ulster unionist. He uses the term Ulsterman and not Irishman. And he asks him, does that mean he's not an Irishman? He says, of course, he says, I use the term Ulsterman as a more particular phrase. Of course, I regard myself as Irish. Now, the Ulster dimension does develop, but it doesn't necessarily remove the Irish thing. It's just that their view of being Irish is different from others who emphasize the language, for example, but they still see themselves as Irish. That's my first point. The second point is this: you're quite right that in the late 19th century, things do polarize. What we see is the emergence in a very clear and distinct way of this division between unionists and nationalists. And of course, unionists are not just in the Northeast, they're also all over Ireland, although in smaller numbers. That's the first point. The second point is that what emerges is a strong correlation between religion and politics. So most unionists are Protestant, most nationalists are Catholics. Now, there are important exceptions, very important exceptions, but that is generally the picture that emerges. And that sets the scene for what happens now in the early 20th century. This division on the one hand over the union, and on the other hand, this correlation with religious divisions. These are quite important.
But Brian, could just talk to us just before, because we won't get a chance to come back to this. What happened to the sort of the liberal, with a big L, liberal Presbyterian tradition, for example? Because they were getting people elected right up to the 1870s, were they not?
Well, yes, they are. And that's very interesting. I mean, in 1880, for example, the Liberal Party in Ulster gets Presbyterian farmers, it gets Catholic farmers. And indeed, up to 1880, this link between religion and politics was by no means clear cut. There were something like 65 Home Rule MPs in 1880, and maybe seven or eight of those were Protestants. You have the Liberals attracting Protestant and Catholic. But in 1885, 86, it's more clear cut, I'm afraid. And the Liberals are no longer such a force. Now, of course, in the case of Ulster, Liberals remain on and become Liberal Unionists, but they're a very small group in this party, and they attract really only Protestant votes.
Now, Margaret, can I bring you in on this, in this question of the polarizing, you know, identities? Like, on the nationalist side, did they have a concept of what was emerging in the Northeast, or did they just ignore it?
Well, I don't think it's evident that the Northeast is the ground of difference until quite late in the century. What you get in the 1880s is, because of an increase in the franchise, you suddenly have this new politics of home rule on the statute books from 1886. So you get a kind of polarization at that moment of democratization. And what's organizing in that period is home rule and the expectation of home rule in nationalist Ireland, and resistance to it, not really by Ulster, but by Irish unionism through organizations like the Irish Unionist Alliance, the Irish Loyal and Patriotic Union. There's the whole issue of the land in there as well. So it's quite a complicated process. I mean, do people in nationalist Ireland, do people like Parnell, take the unionist in Ulster position seriously? Not really, because I don't think he thinks in those terms. I think in the 1880s and the 1890s, Irish nationalists think of Irish unionism rather than of Ulster unionism. It's just, when you look at the map electorally, once you've got a first past the post system, you've substantial numbers of unionists in Cork, in Sligo, in Dublin, but the first past the post system kind of hides them on the map electorally, if that makes sense. So the whole Ulster thing doesn't really, I think, become a new platform until 1905, maybe 1910.
Tell me this, could nationalists have been accused of a certain majoritarian complacency, you know, that which they would later accuse Ulster unionists of within Northern Ireland, right? Martin, do you want to comment on this, this whole thing of identity?
Well, it's difficult, I suppose, because you've had, you know, repeat campaigns for repeal, suddenly Home Rule's put as a realistic proposition for Irish nationalism, and it's really seen as a battle between nationalism and unionism. I don't think nationalism in most of Ireland takes particularly seriously Ulster as a focus until it has to in 1910. But of course, the other issue is nationalist Ireland's expecting home rule, but considerable numbers of Tories, Irish unionists, and indeed Ulster unionists think it can possibly be blocked indefinitely. So there's no, we seem to think that it's inevitable in 1900 that some form of home rule is going to take place for Ireland. But if you go back and look closely at 1902, 1903, 1904, that's not inevitable at the time, you know. I mean, who's going to introduce such a bill? Not the Tories. And when the Liberals get in, they show no desire really to introduce a home rule bill. So can you accuse home rule of a kind of complacent, the home rule position of a complacent majoritarianism? Only up to a point.
Mark Mansour, do you want to come in and comment on that? I think the consensus is then that
I would like to go back considerably earlier. I mean, remember, the Orange Order was founded in 1795. In 1813, and he was referring to Northern Ireland in a geographical rather than political sense, I mean, Peel wrote to the Lord Lieutenant, "The government could scarcely wish to see the lower classes in Northern Ireland united. He hoped they would always be disunited. The great art is to keep them so and yet at peace, or rather not at war with each other." Now, on the subject of one and two nations, let me remind you, there was also a no-nation theory and a three-nation theory. Uh-huh. I mean, as far as three nations, Wolfe Tone briefed the French Directory that there were three nations in Ireland, roughly corresponding to the three main religious denominations. Carson, in the debate on the Government of Ireland Act, and incidentally, he defined himself as a Southern Irishman in that debate. He said Ireland was not a nation, it was a country. And of course, you see, if you argued that Ireland wasn't a nation, well then, fighting for the freedom of small nations as they'd done in the First World War, or self-determination, those were all irrelevant, which was, of course, a very convenient belief to have. And even the two nations, people tend to forget that the famous Moneypenny volume, which Paul Bew has always so strongly recommended, it talks about two Irish nations, not an Irish and a British nation.
Okay. You've complicated things massively there. Thank you for that, Martin. That actually explains quite a bit. Now, I want to get on to the home rule crisis. In the early 20th century, Margaret, just go to you on this, right? Because was this simply a sideshow in a wider political game, a wider Tory-led, anti-democratic, anti-liberal project?
I think what Martin said is quite interesting, that the strategy of British conservatives in the 1880s had been to deny that there was an Irish nation. I mean, that always was Arthur Balfour's position. So I take Martin's point on whether one, two or three nations. The main Tory point had been Ireland was an imperfectly assimilated backward fringe area within the United Kingdom. Now, that may sound ludicrous to us, but it was the propaganda of the time. And also, and not merely were the arguments against home rule centred on Ireland not being a nation, there was an attempt to equate Irish nationality as a concept with criminality. And that runs all through the Tory propaganda and indeed Irish unionist propaganda of the 1880s and 1890s. Now, people talk about the Tories trying to kill home rule by kindness, and we assume that was a doomed endeavour. But actually, once you realise there's very little leverage in Westminster to get a home rule bill on the statute books, there's no desire on the part of the Liberals to do that until they're effectively forced to do so. So I think we need to kind of wind the clock back a bit and realise that home rule was not necessarily thought by most participants at the time to be an inevitability. Now, I suppose one of the ironies of this is that so-called Irish advanced nationalism had almost acquired a disillusionment with the limitations of what Home Rule could be by 1910. So you've got like very different paces of understanding what's on the political agenda in nationalist and unionist Ireland by the early 20th century.
Now, in the you know, once armed militias are formed, right, the formation of the Ulster Volunteers and the Irish Volunteers, I mean, is this when the prospect of partition begins to sort of appear on the horizon? I mean, does it sneak up on people to some extent? Maybe, Martin, would you come in on that, right? I mean, was this, I think we've already agreed it wasn't inevitable, but if it wasn't inevitable, why did it happen?
Well, of course, it was civil war was coming up on the horizon, not just partition. And I mean, somebody like De Valera, who was a standard issue home ruler pre-1914, thought that home rule would probably have to be fought over. I think one thing that is, and this would tie into my view, not inevitable, is that Irish nationalism, whether you're talking of the Redmondite or later the Sinn Féin type nationalism, is they didn't make unionism face up to the cost of partition. I mean, in 1913, Bona Law was terrified that nationalists, instead of sort of blanket opposition to partition, would insist on plebiscites in Fermanagh and Tyrone. In the treaty negotiations in November 21, Lloyd George confided to Tom Jones that you know, could go back to war over you know, oath of allegiance and so on, but nobody would go back to war over Fermanagh and Tyrone. I mean, I think that if Ulster unionism had been made to face up to the fact that, no, they didn't have the choice of 4, 6, 9 counties just as they pleased and just as suited them, but if actually they had been confined to the areas where they were in a majority, and therefore that they would have had to have left a lot more outside than they left in Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal, well then I think then they might have been just a little readier to consider compromise. Remember, they were under quite a bit of pressure between 1916 and 18 because unionism split. I mean, Southern unionism or Irish unionism, if you like, they didn't want partition at any price because it would leave a minority in the 26 counties powerless. And I mean, Carson admitted that he had been put under a lot of pressure in 1917, 1918 at the time of the convention. And of course, the Council of Ireland was one of the devices that they was intended in part to appease not just nationalists, who were never actually very interested in it at that time, but what one might call Irish unionists.
Brian, you want to come in on that?
We should remember in this period there were efforts at compromise. The Irish Convention was one, another was William O'Brien. Now, William O'Brien suggested that nationalists should compromise, and what he recommended with his All for Ireland League, which did terribly well at the 1910 and 1911 election, was the nationalists just shouldn't simply say, we're a majority, and the unions can stuff it. What he suggested was that things should be done such as a veto for such an all-Ireland arrangement, a veto for unionists, like a petition of concern that we have here in Northern Ireland. PR was another thing. These were ideas of compromise within this nationalist framework, but they didn't get very far. So there are these attempts, whether it's William O'Brien, the Irish Convention, but in the end they come to nothing, and in the end we proceed on to the Government of Ireland Act.
Well, sorry, I want to come back to PR later, Brian, when we look at the Government of Ireland Act in detail. But I want to bring Cormac in on the significance of the 1916 rising. Did this to an extent, if you like, let Ulster Unionists off the hook. I mean, in a sense, up to 1914, they were almost being cast as rebels, if you like. You know, they were threatening armed action against the government of the United Kingdom. I mean, did 1916 get them off the hook?
Well, I think, just going back a bit on what Martin said about, you know, there was nothing inevitable really about, you know, the solutions in 1914. A lot happened afterwards. If you were to go back even to 1911, would you have envisaged what was going to happen 10 years later? And actually an Ulster devolved parliament of six counties. And even with what happened in 1916 with the Easter Rising, it's often been overstated that, you know, this psychological partition, there's this huge big schism developed more than ever before. So I think it had been overstated. There was still a lot of pressure on Ulster Unionists, as Martin said, to compromise and to agree to an All-Ireland Parliament. And that pressure continued right up throughout the treaty negotiations. Lloyd George still tried to squeeze Craig to agree to a Northern Ireland being in an All-Ireland Parliament in July and November of 1921. Sinn Féin, obviously there was this difference, you know, huge difference between how Irish nationalists developed from 1916, and even Ulster Unionists as well. And if you look at 1916, the difference that year had in terms of, you know, you've got one side, you have this this treachery, as Ulster Unionists saw, of the 1916 Rising, versus the heroic experience of Ulster Unionists in the Battle of the Somme. So there definitely was a divergence that developed at that time.
Martin, you want to come in on that?
Just very briefly to say, I think actually the 1916 Rising put Ulster Unionism and especially Carson under quite a lot of additional pressure, and that's maybe one of the reasons why he agreed with Redmond on the scheme in June, July 1916 to bring in Home Rule immediately in the 26 counties, because he was blamed in part for the 1916 Rising because he had set the example of paramilitarism.
Okay, can I just go back to Cormac here on Sinn Féin, because one of the consequences of the 1916 Rising was the rise of Sinn Féin at the expense of the Redmondite Irish Parliamentary Party. What was Sinn Féin's policy on partition, Cormac?
Well, it's actually very hard to find it, really, because it was very incoherent for the most part. You have to remember, Sinn Féin was a lot weaker in Ulster than it was anywhere else in Ireland. Even the, you know, leading Sinn Féin members who were born in Ulster, I'm like Ernest Bligh and Sean McEntee, they were more experienced with Southern politics than the North. So if you look at the main policies they would have had when they became the leading voice of Irish nationalism would have been the Belfast boycott after the shipyard expulsions of July 1920. And then later on, as an iteration of Sinn Féin, the First Irish Free State Government introduced the customs barriers in 1923. So they are actually quite counterproductive and led to an increased likelihood of partitioning happening. Other than that, it was very incoherent. There was this kind of naive belief that once Britain left Ireland, Ulster Unionism would happily come into United Ireland. Very naive, and it really downplayed the intense hostility of Ulster Unionists being in a Dublin Parliament.
Martin, can I bring you in on that? Because if Sinn Féin had incoherent policies on partition, they had very specific economic policies, which wouldn't necessarily go down well.
Well, they did. I mean, the first point I would make is they used the partition issue as a means of battering at the parliamentary party, because Devlin and so on had seemed to agree in principle in July 1916 to a partition scheme, even if they withdrew them. But of course, the trouble is, it meant that when you can't come to the treaty period, they were deeply embarrassed and needed some sort of fig leaf for agreeing to partition. So I would be really quite critical of Sinn Féin in that regard. But yes, I mean, I think the thing that more than anything else probably contributed, or certainly one of the main things that contributed to the failure of the Irish Convention was the what one might call the Sinn Féin economic policy, even though Sinn Féin wasn't at the convention. Now, Redmond died at the beginning of March 1918, and there's some evidence that he would have been prepared to compromise on, shall we say, a protectionist policy. But I mean, there's no doubt that the Northeast, which was sort of fully integrated into the UK economy, the Industrial Revolution, imperial markets, and so on, is that the type of policy that might have suited the rest of the country, did not suit them at all. And that, indeed, I mean, was an underlying issue, you know, right through to the 30s, that, you know, the complete divergence of economic interests and economic policies, which has only, you know, come back together again in much more recent decades.
Can I just come in here?
Yeah, Margaret, yeah.
I think we have kind of, in talking about whether partition was inevitable or not, I think we really need to go back and think again about the foundation of the Ulster Volunteer Force and the whole structure and paramilitarization of politics in Ireland really does begin with that. Now, we talk about putting Ireland in an international context. I think you can argue that the arming and militarization of the Ulster Volunteers inaugurates a new chapter in Irish politics, but it's also perhaps the first such paramilitary organization in Europe at the time. And the other thing I think we probably need to go back to is think about how the UVF, how they were armed and how they were placed in a position of leverage by a lot of their Tory allies. So we're talking to some degree now about other outcomes, 1916, the 1917 convention, but these only make sense in the larger frame of the paramilitarization and polarization and incipient civil war that was in place in 1914. So that's the frame of our discussion, and I don't think we should forget it. And I mean, the convention, but by the time of the Irish Convention in 1917, Ulster Unionists were not willing to play ball in that context at all. And I think that that confidence they'd acquired before the war, through that paramilitarization, conditioned their responses in association with the support they got from Tories and from coalition governments.
Now, Brian, can I go to you on this? Because in relation to the 1917 convention, would it be true to say that the most ardent anti-partitionists at this stage were Southern Unionists?
Yes, well, certainly Southern Unionists were against partition. And there is a break in the ranks here. But at the end of the day, nothing comes out of all of this. We return then to a situation where it leads up to the 1918 general election, and then we find a resumption of violence. The Irish National Volunteers then become the IRA, and so violence now becomes once again an important part of the whole picture.
Now, I want to go back to Margaret, and because I want to get on to the actual the Government of Ireland Act itself, the 1920 Act. Now, Margaret, was I correct in my introduction by describing this as Home Rule Mark IV, or more or less? Would that be correct? I mean, could you just give us like what its provisions were, very briefly?
I mean, I don't think it really is Home Rule Mark IV, because what it actually is an Ulster Parliament Mark I. So I see it as a breach with the three previous Home Rule bills. And its effective purpose, as I think most scholars have agreed, was to establish something in Ulster and ignore what's going on in the rest of Ireland. So in theory, it sets up two subordinate parliaments on the island, two mini home rules, but it doesn't embrace any of the principles that even by 1914 were deemed to be essential by Irish nationalists. So I don't think its intention, if you look at the role of Walter Long's committee, if you look at the attitude of the British government from the end of the war, their response to the Sinn Féin electoral success, I mean, they're really not taking on board the scale of the transformation in nationalist Ireland, and they seal that out of the picture and decide that they're going to make provision for their own people in Ulster. So there's a kind of continuum from before the war, through the war, the role that significant Irish and Ulster unionists, Carson, Stradling, Bope, have made during the war. So there's a very hostile attitude towards all forms of Irish nationalism by the British cabinet by 1918. And this Government of Ireland Act is really effectively an act to copper fasten something that's been there as an idea for some time, and that is an entity in the Northeast, whether 4, 6, or 9 counties, that will protect Ulster unionists.
Cormac, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I agree with Margaret that the Government of Ireland Act was Ulster Parliament Act number one, because it was a way of solving the Ulster question and not the Irish question, you know, by offering nationalists far less than they desired and unionists far more than they ever asked for. I do think the international context is important as well, in that the partitioning Ireland wasn't just about what happened in Ireland over the previous decades. It was also what was happening in Europe and straight after the First World War, that there were a lot of partitions happening, and there was a lot of attempts to resolve kind of ethno-community conflicts. And in reality, the Government of Ireland Act was an attempt by the British Empire really to continue its lifespan, you know, to offer some form of acceptance of self-government whilst keeping the British Empire. And they repeated that in India and Palestine, and as did the French Empire elsewhere as well.
Just before, I want to go to Margaret, but just before, I want to just go back to Margaret very briefly, Margaret. Was the act meant to be temporary? I mean, was partition meant to be temporary? Or was that just window dressing?
There's that brilliant line where it's in Ronan Fanning's Fatal Path, that what that act did was it partitioned Ireland. And in the language of the statesmen who did it, it was left to, so the British partitioned Ireland and it was left to the Irish, North and South, to undo it. I don't think the Council of Ireland had that much capacity within it. And I don't really think that Bonar Law or Lloyd George seriously thought beyond the actual Partition Act. Okay, there was, in theory, this framework of a Council of Ireland. Maybe partition could be undone. But that whole line, borders once erected, harden into permanence, I think is, you know, very apposite about the partition of the so-called Fourth Home Rule Bill, but actually the first Parliament for Ulster Bill.
So Margaret's completely shot out of the water in my introduction. That's fine, Margaret. I want to go to Brian in a minute, but Brian, I'll be in a second. I want to go to Martin first, though, on the Council of Ireland. I mean, how serious an institution was this, or was this just window dressing?
No, I think it probably was window dressing. But if I could just come back on something, I don't entirely agree with the sort of consensus that has now grown amongst historians that really the Government of Ireland Act was simply about securing and entrenching and fencing off Northern Ireland. I think, and this comes right through in the rhetoric from 1917 through, in fact, even into the 1930s, a British determination felt particularly strongly by Lloyd George and Churchill is that they were absolutely determined that Ireland was not to become a sovereign independent state. I mean, remember, a fierce war, and you know, we've only just passed the centenary of a Bloody Sunday, was taking place. And I mean, this was meant to sort of put, they simply ignored the 1918 general election result, went ahead with their own scheme, even though it wasn't going to consensus, but what they were absolutely determined about, and even in the treaty negotiation. Now, in fact, I mean, it was actually vain. I mean, Lloyd George said in the debates, without foreign relations, there can be no self-determination. What did the Dáil do on its first day but send a message to the free countries of the world and sort of start lobbying intensively? Bona Law, who I think was not in government at the time, in 1920, admitted that so-called Dominion Home Rule, which of course they were opposed at that stage, in a case of country like Canada, they couldn't stop it going independent, and it had control of it, control of its defences. So when you came to the truce of the treaty, somehow or other, Dominion Home Rule and so on wasn't approached in as realistic a manner as possible. But even in the early 1930s, time the economic war, Lloyd George was giving out about, isn't it perfectly ridiculous that Dev is still going on about being a sovereign independent state, and this was something that couldn't be tolerated by Britain. Now, I'm afraid I think this is one of the things that was responsible for fairly poor relations for a long time afterwards, is the unwillingness to accept that Ireland, as one of the promotions for the for the bonds that they were raising, compared Ireland to Poland, and I think they called it Bohemia. But it was a period when a dozen new states were being formed around Europe, and Ireland wanted to be part of that. Its problem, of course, is it wasn't part of a defeated empire, and indeed some people accused it of being allied to the defeated central powers, and that was something that had to be got over, even though, of course, the contribution to the Allied war effort had been very considerable, and that was something that certainly counted for Ireland a bit in America.
Martin, would it be true to say, in terms of Woodrow Wilson's concept of self-determination, that the British concept of this post-war was the idea of dominions, and white dominions at that, and they wanted to slot Ireland into that framework?
The British were absolutely opposed to self-determination. The first time we got them to use the word self-determination in an Irish context was in the Downing Street Declaration of 1993.
We'll come to that later. So, Brian, you've been waiting patiently to get in on this part of the discussion.
I just want to say, in my opinion, by 1918, there was really no alternative to partition. It reflected divisions. It didn't actually cause them. There were these divisions there that had to be dealt with. Now, think of the alternative. If there had been a 32-county state-imposed run from Dublin with an oath of allegiance, what would have happened then? Tom Garvin has written, it have ended up not with one civil war, but two civil wars in Munster and in Ulster. Sinn Féin was more interested in promoting Irish sovereignty, ideas of a republic, than it was of trying to attain a united Ireland, a unitary island. And in the absence of compromise from the Unionists, in absence of compromise from Sinn Féin, there was no alternative to partition at this stage.
But Brian, you mentioned there are two civil wars. Isn't that precisely what we got? Because, you participated in a previous head school we had on the Belfast pogrom, 1920-22. By the way, on the question of whether that term is applicable, you can check out the correspondence in the current and the next issue of History Ireland. Let's sidestep that for the moment, but that's what it's referred to. And this leads to my next question. Did Ulster Unionists have the advantage that they had a clear policy in favour of partition, and with the formation of the Special Constabulary, they had the means to defend it?
Well, that is true, but none of this was inevitable. And I think I wouldn't go along with the idea that this Council of Ireland was a completely bogus thing. The Ulster Unionists did nominate people to sit on the council. Hugh Pollock, who was a Unionist MP, was asked in 1921-22 about the Council of Ireland. He said he thought in the end it could well lead to better relations, which might lead ultimately to union. We don't know if that could have happened. What we do know is that in 1973, the Irish government was very keen on the Council of Ireland. And even today, I think would be politicians who'd be very keen on a Council of Ireland. So I think we're wrong to just dismiss it out of hand.
Cormac, you want to come in there?
Yes, just on the first thing about the two civil wars, I would agree with what you said, Tommy, that there kind of was two civil wars. The violence in the north, and particularly from the first half of 1922, was a civil war in all but name. And it was pretty much to either the you could say it was two things: the draconian laws that the northern government brought in, plus the civil war in the south, and that stopped further violence in the north from the summer of 1922. On the second point, just on what Brian said about partition was the only solution from 1918. There definitely is some truth to that in terms of there was a clear division, and the partition was basically looking at what the situation on the ground was. But what wasn't clear was how that partition was going to actually end up. What was the actual final partition solution going to be? Was it to be that a devolved Northern Ireland Parliament of six counties? That wasn't clear at all. And that's where the problem of the partition solution really comes down to, is that all of the cards were stacked in favour of Ulster Unionists and none towards nationalists, and the British government were implicit and complicit in supporting Ulster Unionist demands. And it comes down to ultimately Tyrone and Fermanagh, that had a majority of nationalists within their counties. If there was such a thing as a fair solution, then Tyrone and Fermanagh would have had different solutions, I think.
Sorry, Mark, do you want to come in there?
I mean, there are some people, I'm not saying I subscribe this to myself, but who regard, the War of Independence, particularly in its earlier stages, as a civil war. I mean, if you look at something like Solihull Beg, two Catholic RIC constables, one of them Irish-speaking, shot. I mean, there was an element of, a lot of the RIC outside of Ulster would have been moderate nationalists, home rulers probably in their politics. So just to make that point. Now, the second one about the Council of Ireland. Now, of course, the Council of Ireland put North and South on an even keel, equal representation. But I can't find any evidence of serious interest by nationalists in the Council of Ireland in the 1920-25 period, and it was let go on sort of vague and meaningless assurances by James Craig that we'd do this all much better informally. So, the interest is later on, and of course what frustrates me a little bit about later on is when unionists were jumping up and down about the Council of Ireland, nobody looked at the history, and because they should have said, well, this was a British and Unionist idea in the first place, not a nationalist one.
A bit like Thatcher, the single market in Europe was actually an idea of Margaret Thatcher. That's another discussion. Margaret, can I bring you back in here on, just moving on to the treaty, right? Now, was partition, and specifically a six-county partition, a prerequisite before negotiation could begin? And once it was in position, was that a fait accompli?
Well, I mean, I suppose the whole thing is anomalous, because the negotiations leading up to the treaty put the Irish negotiators in the position of negotiating on behalf of all Ireland. So, in theory, Northern Ireland is set up by the Government of Ireland Act of 1920. It's got a considerable apparatus in place by December 1921, yet the treaty legislates for the northern counties to opt out of that settlement, as Government of Ireland Act had never happened in the first place. And moreover, it provides for a boundary commission to allegedly, insofar as they may be compatible with economic and geographic considerations, the wishes of the inhabitants to be checked at some future date. So that whole language of the treaty opens up again what Ulster Unionists had assumed had been closed by the Government of Ireland Act. So you've somebody like Craig all through the early 1920s first of all, trying to stop the Boundary Commission ever happening, but also spending a lot of time lobbying at Westminster, going to clubs, talking to unionist politicians, because he says he should never have taken his eye off the ball at the time of the treaty.
Well, that brings me to the next question, Margaret. I mean, were the Irish negotiators, Collins, Griffith, etc., asleep at the wheel in relation to the Boundary Commission? That they didn't look at the small print, which leads me to my next speculation, that did they really want to stop partition? I mean,
I think they probably wanted, if they could, to. I mean, I think it's all a question of perspective. The whole Anglo-Irish War has been going on for 2 years. Ulster Unionists have been focusing clearly on getting what they wanted. The Irish demands are much more inchoate. They want an Irish Republic. The negotiators know they're probably going to get that. So they're in a very difficult position in terms of what Lloyd George, you know, if you look at Tom Jones's diaries, they're not going to concede to the treaty negotiators what they want. De Valera claims he'd kind of instructed them to break on the question of Ulster rather than on the oath, and Griffith is supposed to have got into private conversations through which he made commitments. But I mean, the bottom line is that the power balance is extremely unequal, and any kind of a treaty signed at that time probably was not going to fulfil the Irish expectations.
Maybe just for our listeners, maybe Cormac, if you could just explain. I know the Boundary Commission report was never published, it was leaked, right? What was the rationale for it to actually increase the land area of Northern Ireland rather than decrease it as nationalists had hoped? Why did that happen, briefly?
Well the plan was that there would be increase of some parts of East Donegal would have gone to Northern Ireland, but most of the increases would have gone to the Irish Free State. That was a huge shock to Irish nationalists who never felt that any part of the Irish Free State would have potentially gone into Northern Ireland. But going back, if I may, to the treaty negotiations, I do believe that Sinn Féin wanted either to end or limit partition, and really did believe naively that the Boundary Commission would lead to that. And I think we do have to ask that question about the fine print of the Boundary Commission and how Sinn Féin blundered spectacularly and they could have just looked at other partitions, you know, in Upper Silesia and other places where it was very clearly determined that population would outrank economic or geographic means. And why didn't they stick to that or insist on that within the treaty negotiations really does baffle me. They never insisted on getting a plebiscite either or something like that, because that I think would have made the Boundary Commission a lot more meaningful if they had it set in stone. Like De Valera admitted decades later that they should have had legal people look at the Boundary Commission. Why didn't you think of that in 1921? You know, it really was a spectacular blunder, in my opinion, of how they allowed the Boundary Commission Article 12 to be so ambiguous and to be interpreted in so many different ways. And with a 2-1 majority as well on the Kiatra Commission, you know, one person from the Irish Free State, one person from the British government, and one person from the Northern government, they should have had made sure that it was watertight in terms of its provisions.
But to add insult to injury from the point of view of border nationalists, I mean, very little time was spent in the treaty debates on the question of the border or the Boundary Commission. Brian Walker, do you want to come in on that?
Yes, it's very interesting. In the treaty debates, there was very little talk about the North. And I think the reason for that was a lot of faith was put in this Boundary Commission. What people thought was the Boundary Commission wouldn't just take a bit of territory here and a bit of territory there. They'd make Northern Ireland unviable. And that's what a lot of people expected. Now, that's what nationalists expected. But unionists, on the other hand, also saw that danger. So they took steps to mitigate against that. So the first thing they do is they refuse to appoint anyone to the commission. That goes on for several years. And then they take steps to make sure that this commission reports to their advantage. So proportional representation is removed in elections in 1922. This is anticipation of the Boundary Commission. Then the boundaries are redrawn of council areas. Now, nationalists suddenly wake up to what has happened. So Churchill, Collins gives off to Churchill in 1922 in opposition to the removal of PR, saying the purpose of this is to paint the counties of Tyrone and Fermanagh the deep orange tint. And that's exactly what happened. Likewise, after the boundary lines are drawn, Ernest Blythe in 1925 comments on this, and he says, but for the Boundary Commission, the gerrymandering in Fermanagh Tyrone would not have been carried out to the extent it was, and it's carried out because of the fear of these boundary changes. Now, it has to be said that, of course, Ernest Blythe himself was quite capable of making boundary changes when it suited him, which is what he did. But this was a reaction, and I think nationalists thought this is what would happen, and it's not unexpected that unions would take these steps to prevent it.
Now, Martin, do you want to come in there before, and then I go to Cormac?
Yes. First of all, I'd say, you know, the Boundary Commission was an idea that was around the place between 1919 and 21, and unionists at one point were quite favourable to the idea, but when it came to the treaty, they took a different view. Now, in the case of Collins, it isn't just a question, did he believe naively or otherwise in sort of Lloyd George's blandishments and sort of encouraging hopes that it would take most of what was Northern Ireland. I think he thought that he would be able, if necessary, to judiciously deploy force to make the state unviable. And of course, as we know, he engaged with Mulcahy on what in retrospect seems a very ill-advised attempt to destabilise the North, militarily speaking, in the early summer of 1922, perhaps in a vain idea that this might help bridge the emerging Civil War division. Now, of course, post-Civil War, I forget the precise name of it, but the Free State government set up a Northeast Boundary Bureau. It did very good work, but it was all far too late focusing on it at that stage. And of course, in the end, Craig was lobbying for give us Donegal, Donegal as a whole, as I hasten to add. And the final point I'd make is Mrs. Thatcher, who was, of course, spectacularly ill-informed on Irish history, she felt that a bad job had been done on partition, and maybe some transplantation policies that had been exercised vaguely sometime in the past, and I think an advisor prompted her, yes, Cromwell, I should have been employed instead.
I just want to move things on a little bit, I just make a, in terms of, you know, was it a fair solution or not? Because did partition create a trap, if you like, for both communities? So an endless cycle of disaffection by nationalists, which provoked and justified repression and discrimination by unionists, which in turn reinforced disaffection by nationalists, and round it went. I mean, what are people's views on that? Brian, maybe if you would comment on that.
No, I don't think it was inevitable that this happened. We sometimes think that, I've read a number of books recently that make the point that things were so bad in these early 1920s that the scene was then set irrevocably towards sort of discourse. It was set towards conflict. I disagree with that. When this is all over, by 1925, 1926, there is an effort in Northern Ireland to try and put things behind people and to move on. Now, there are quotes I can give you from Cardinal O'Donnell, from Devlin, from unionist politicians, saying they want to try and make things work. Now is the time for reconciliation. This doesn't happen. But let me illustrate it with the case of James Craig. Now, James Craig is well known for a statement in the 1930s, ours a Protestant government and I'm an Orangeman. He would not have said that in the 1920s. In 1922, the question is raised in Northern Ireland Parliament to make the 12th of July a public holiday. Craig says, no, you can't have it. Too many of these public holidays. So the next year, 1923, it does become a public holiday, but Craig doesn't go back to the field. In fact, he doesn't go back the next year or the following year, and it's only in 1927 that he finally turns up at an Orange parade. This is the man who, 10 years later, is emphasizing the Orange link. And it's interesting, why does he go back in 1927 to the Orange field on the 12th of July? On that occasion, the Irish News on the eve of it says how things are getting better. But what Craig has to say changes things. And what he raises is not the question of the South. He refers to our friendly neighbours in the Irish Free State. It's not the nationalists. He refers very respectfully to Mr. Devlin. But what he's on about is the problem that unionists face from independent unionists. In 1921, they get 40 seats. This is down to 32 by 1924. By 1927, they face a real problem over temperance issues on a number of intoxicating bills in Stormont, and not Stormont, in the Northern Ireland Parliament in 1927. Their vote is cut in half. So he's there to say, from now on, we're going to seek to abolish PR. And that's what he does. So in 1929, PR is abolished. Now, nationalists are affected by this, and not in the sense of losing representation. The nationalist number of seats goes up in 1929 by one. But what it means is they can no longer hope to get support from Labour or independents. You may remember in 1932, when Fianna Fáil come to power, they don't have a majority, but they're helped by other parties. Now, this is now gone for the unionists, gone for the nationalists. That's one point. And the second point is that Craig is now responding to what he sees in the South. And in the 1930s, we have much more emphasis on Catholicism. So we have Craig now talking of we're a Protestant parliament and a Protestant state. And he says this in response. In the South, they boast of a Catholic state. In 1937, when the Irish Constitution mentioned the special position of the Catholic Church, Craig's asked about this. Would he condemn it? He said, no, he wouldn't, he said. He's no objection to this. And he says that while the government of the South is based on lines suitable for the Catholic majority, so in Northern Ireland, things should be run according to the Protestant majority. So things have changed. So I don't believe in 1925, things were irrevocably set in a course that would lead to conflict. There were opportunities, but by the 1930s, these had gone.
Cormac, do you want to come in on that? I mean, just on the question, like, you know, how fair a solution was it in the end from a post-25?
If I might just go back on what Brian was saying about Craig, when he says that he wouldn't have said, it's a Protestant parliament for Protestant people in the 20s, I think I would go back a little bit earlier. I think perhaps, from 1919 to 1921, mid to 1921, he wouldn't have. But afterwards, he was listening to more hardliners within either Conservative Party or within his own Ulster Unionist Party, and people like Dawson Bates. And his actions speak volumes, you know, in terms of, agreeing to the Special Powers Act and getting rid of a PR for local elections in 1922. So I think he had moved a lot from his more moderate stance from the mid-1921. In fact, Arthur Griffith noted that during negotiations, he noticed a significant change in Craig's demeanour and words and actions during the negotiations. So just to make that point. The short answer was partition a fair solution? No, I don't think it was, because it didn't safeguard minorities. Even the Government of Ireland Act was meant to safeguard all religions, and it was clear that the people most affected negatively by partition were Northern nationalists, Northern Catholics, and the partition solution did nothing for them whatsoever. I think it wasn't a fair solution. And if it was based on really listening to unionists and nationalists' fears and desires and trying to reach a compromise there, I think it does come down to Tyrone and Fermanagh in many respects, that if it was to be a partisan solution, Lord Middleton, the Southern Unionist, said that, you know, who was talking quite extensively with De Valera in the build-up to the treaty negotiations, that Sinn Féin would have accepted Tyrone and Fermanagh. And you know, there could have potentially been a solution on that basis. So as it transpired, you know, the stacks were against nationalists and were given to Ulster Unionists by the British government.
Mark, do you want to come in on that?
I mean, they didn't really focus on Fermanagh and Tyrone. I mean, they were so content on, you know, the blanket opposition to partition that, as I say, they didn't make them pay the price. Now, when you say, and it was an argument that came up in the Government of Ireland Act debates about protection of minorities, I mean, the two minorities were in a very different position from two points of view. I mean, one is the obvious one of difference in size, but the other one was that the minority in the South, despite the depredations of revolution, it was on average better off than the majority, rather than was the case of the nationalist minority in the North. And my view would be is that once the situation sort of settled down again, that actually, you know, the minority carried on in the South, you know, reasonably well. Yes, there was sort of pressure from the church, and there would have been pressure from ideologues and so on, who would almost want to have excluded them from the Irish nation. But in terms of, you know, material conditions and professional conditions, I mean, in some ways it was a kind of almost classic post-colonial situation. And I just think that there isn't, you know, notwithstanding sort of laws on certain social matters. And remember, you know, most Protestants were and are still fairly conservative, so, and not as liberal as they are sometimes painted.
Now, I'll tell you what here. Could I come in here?
Yes, Margaret, yes.
Yeah, I think partition was a disaster. And in thinking about partition, we always think of it as establishing Northern Ireland. It also created the boundaries of what became what is today Ireland or the Republic of Ireland. And it fossilised the sectarian divisions. A 25% Protestant minority on the whole island would have created very different politics to what we got. The lie of the border meant that politics in the North was dominated by the fear of removing or pulling back what they'd got. And similarly, a lot of politics in the South was determined by the overwhelming majority of Catholics who were there, which shaped the kind of Catholic moral ethos of the state. And the subdivisions that exist within Belfast and all over, there's a kind of a partitioning within the North as a consequence of the overall partitioning. And also, when we talk about the Boundary Commission, we keep forgetting about the nationalists of Belfast. If you talk about deaths in this period between 1920 and 22, 500 people die in the new Northern Ireland. Now, they're not, and a lot of them are as a consequence of attacks on Catholics, particularly in Belfast and also in Derry. The other thing is the British government does not continue to in any way supervise the powers it's granted to what is deemed to be still a part of the United Kingdom. And so therefore, unionists are almost permitted and encouraged in a kind of carnival of reaction over the following decades.
Now, I've kept an eye on the time. I'm going to have to wrap up here, right? But Martin, I want to go to you because you were party to the Good Friday Agreement, and I just wanted to ask you, like, how central then was the Government of Ireland Act to the Good Friday Agreement? Its repeal, rather.
Well, I think it was a significant part of it. It provided a little bit of balance in the constitutional accommodation. Now, the repeal of the Government of Ireland Act 1920 was mainly symbolic. Albert Reynolds, when he became Taoiseach, he brought it onto the table so that there was a bit of reciprocity. I think the previous thinking, say, of Charles Haughey would be, well, you would compensate for constitutional change by having... significant north-south bodies, but I think Albert added that a bit, so it was significant. And I think also people were conscious that the safeguards that were supposed to be in the Government of Ireland Act against discrimination, I mean, they all fell by the wayside. I mean, PR, the Council of Ireland, and a general sort of non-discrimination clause. I mean, none of them proved effective. But I suppose what you have now is that the North-South ministerial body, maybe has some sort of distant ancestry in or distant resemblance to the stillborn Council of Ireland. I mean, things like animal health, for example, which was to be a function of the Council of Ireland, is certainly a function of the North-South ministerial council.
So, Brian, you want to come in there very quickly before we wrap up?
Just a couple of quick points. Things were very bad in the 1920s, but perhaps not as bad as elsewhere. I mean, there was displacement of population. But remember, the number of Catholics in Belfast between 1911 and 1926 actually goes up. And compared to other places like Silesia or India, where there's partition, there's not the same mass movement of population. And that's the first point. The second point is Southern Protestants, you're quite right, do fit in with the new environment, and most of them are quite happy. But those on the border, that's not the case. I mean, in 1934, 5,000 East Donegal Protestants signed a petition asking for the border to be changed so they can be brought into Northern Ireland. So not everybody was happy. My final point is this, that the point's been made that for Catholics in Ulster, in Northern Ireland, partition was a disaster. That can be argued in many ways. But what has to be pointed out is the big difference between Northern Ireland and the Irish Free State and Republic between 1926-61 is that in the north, the population goes up. The population goes down in the south. The population in the north goes up by 13%. The population in the south falls by 5%. The Catholic population increases by 18%. The only community of Catholics in Ireland to increase is in Northern Ireland. It's not in the Republic. Mm-hmm. So that point has to be made when we're making these remarks about partition. In fact, for the Catholic community, their numbers grow. Their numbers fall in the Republic.
Okay, guys, I'm going to have to wrap it up there. And we didn't get a chance to move on to, of course, partition as it reared its head with us today, Brexit. But I think none of us have a crystal ball here. We're not party to the current negotiations. But listen, I've got to leave it there, guys. I'm going to thank our panel, Martin Manser, Cormac Moore, Margaret O'Callaghan, and Brian Walker. And our next History Ireland Head School, which will be posted in the middle of December, will be looking at Wicklow in the revolutionary decade. That's the first of two head schools. So listeners, I hope you'll tune in for that one. Thank you very much.